Welcome to The Financial Bite. This episode is brought to you by BNY Mellon in collaboration with Finadium. I'm Anaïs Schmidt, and together we will explore leading topics in finance and economics, interviews with thinkers, movers, and shakers in global finance to learn what's happening and what's next. Today, I've invited some luminaries in the world of treasury market structure to talk about what is ripe for improvement in that market. So let me hand it over to our esteemed guests.
Hi, I'm Pat Parkinson, senior fellow at the Bank Policy Institute and a former director of banking supervision at the Federal Reserve. I'm here today to talk about the structural cracks that seem to be forming in the U.S. government bond market and why they seem to be causing more volatility more frequently. I'm delighted to be joined by a host of experts on the subject. Brian Ruan, who runs BNY Mellon's Treasury Settlement and Collateral Management business. Laura Klimple, who manages the Treasury Markets Clearinghouse at the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation. And Rob Toomey, head of the Capital Markets Group at the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, better known as SIFMA. Before we hear from them, let's get into why this issue begs some investigation. Few issues could be more critical to the health of markets and the economy than the smooth functioning of the U.S. Treasury markets. Yields on treasuries serve as benchmarks to provide pricing of all other financial assets. Investors around the globe rely on treasuries to meet their need for liquidity under stress. The U.S. government relies on it to meet its growing needs for funding, and the Federal Reserve relies on it to implement monetary policy. But in recent years, the market has been experiencing some dysfunction, and expectations of more treasury debt outstanding, coupled with a tapering off of Fed bond purchases, has some experts worried that the frequency of those episodes might increase without measures to address the underlying problems. Stay with us as we unpack some of those ideas for reform. Taking one initiative where efforts already have been made, that's the standing repo facility, why do some feel it is inadequate in its current form? Is access to that facility sufficiently broad? What other aspects of the facility that the Fed has created could limit its effectiveness? Brian, would you like to offer your thoughts on that subject?
Yes. Thank you, Pat. The standing repo facility essentially assures the market that there will be a market for U.S. treasuries at all times. So I think it's largely been seen as being positive and as addressing one of the central concerns from March 2020. Now onto some of the commentary around how it could potentially be improved. The first is the timing of access. It's now available once per day, and there's been some commentary on whether that should be available at more than a set time per day, whether it should be made available throughout the day. And I would say that'll be something that I'm certain will evolve over time. But it's certainly a positive starting point that it is available. And operationally, I think, is the second. In terms of the operations of the standing repo facility, the pipes or the connectivity between current tri-party market participants and BNY Mellon are in place. And BNY Mellon is the main tri-party service provider. So for those who are already a tri-party client or are already using tri-party, it'll feel similar. It's a very valuable new tool that is available to the market, but I think the onboarding of that will feel like something that they know and will readily understand. For non-clients and for non-tri-party market participants, they will have to go through the process of entering into an agreement with the Fed, and I think that there'll be some practical aspects of onboarding. So there's an element of that that would need, there'll be a training component of it and a legal component of it. But we are actively looking to ensure that the onboarding and the operational aspects of making this important tool available to those participants that qualify to use it, that it's made available to them.
Thanks, Brian. Laura, would you like to add something to that?
Absolutely. As Brian noted, adding the standing repo facility as a tri-party style facility is definitely going to create a lot of operational efficiencies for the firms that use it. I just wanted to add that one thing that we hear very frequently from our members is that the facility could be even more efficient from a balance sheet and a capital standpoint if it were to clear at FICC. And the reason for that is because firms that access the standing repo facility, if that facility were to clear, then the activity they do through it would be nettable from a balance sheet standpoint and potentially ultimately from an operational standpoint with their other FIC cleared activity. And that could certainly help to ease the capital burden that accessing the facility would otherwise create if they were to do it bilaterally. I think one other interesting aspect, if you're going to think about potentially clearing the standing repo facility, is that it could be a useful way of expanding who should be eligible to access it, in the sense that to the extent that there is a policy interest in giving access to, let's call them non-dealer market participants like hedge funds and other types of players, having the activity clear at FIC, particularly if the activity was facilitated by a sponsoring dealer or bank, could be another elegant means of expanding the access to the facility beyond the dealer community while also ensuring the safety and soundness of the clearinghouse. So those would be my thoughts to add.
All right. And I think next we're going to turn to central clearing, which is a number one of the major issues in treasury market reform. So start with Laura. Why is wider clearing viewed by some as a potentially powerful means of enhancing the liquidity of the treasury and treasury repo markets? How can wider clearing be achieved? In particular, FIC and the principal trading firms that play such an important role in the, particularly the on-the-run treasury market, identified the best market model for clearing PTF trades? And why is repo clearing growing organically much more rapidly than clearing of cash trades? If you could start out and give your perspectives on those issues, and I think we'll want Rob to weigh in.
Okay, thanks, Pat. Central clearing can't solve for supply-demand mismatches in a market. If there are more buyers than sellers, central clearing cannot make up that gap. But to the extent market stress creates the eventuality of a dealer default, that's when central clearing and our consolidated risk management and default management practices can assist in stabilizing and keeping the market from otherwise further destabilizing as a result of that type of a default. Proponents of central clearing typically point to its value in reduction of fire sale risk. They also point to our unique ability to net settlement obligations. This has been spoken about a lot in the recent policy discussions. At FICC, we are able to net down multilaterally across all of our members' transactions in Treasury securities a single deliver or receive obligation versus the CCP per CUSIP. And that certainly is something that creates a lot of operational efficiency in the market, as opposed to market participants all having to gross settle their obligations. And it also cuts down significantly on the risk of settlement failure. So for those risk management reasons and also for the settlement efficiency reasons, you know, those are the main reasons why folks, I think, are focusing on potentially broadening the scope of what comes into central clearing in the treasury market. Certainly, from my vantage point, we have seen, particularly when we're talking about the buy side firms, we're seeing more of that activity migrate involuntarily. And as we wrote about in our May white paper, we believe that to be the case because repo activity has a much more punitive impact on the balance sheet and on the capital that dealers have to reserve than cash market buy sell activity does. So we really believe that that's what the priority of the market has been, to bring that activity into central clearing, because when those constraints of the balance sheet and capital are alleviated, it helps produce more liquidity. It helps produce more capacity for everyone in the market to be able to transact with each other.
Thank you, Rob.
Yeah, and on that, Laura was getting to this at the end of her remarks. I think it's very important when we think about, you know, central clearing and the benefits central clearing brings and the incentives that are created to come into central clearing. We think about the market in a segmented way. There is obviously the cash market and there is the repo market. Laura was talking a lot about the repo market, where there has been changes and significant uptake of FICC's sponsored repo model. I think that's been well received, certainly by the dealer community, well received by the sponsored entities to get in, and it's had a real benefit in that market. There are clearly within the repo market incentives, capital incentives, netting incentives for market participants to come in. So that, as you said, and Pat, I think you used the right word, on the repo market has been growing organically over time through new products and services. The cash market may present a little different sort of profile, and I think we need to think about it as we move forward and bring in more entities into clearing within the cash market. We need to understand what the benefits are clearly, and Laura was outlining some of those benefits, the netting benefits, how much of that is there? And then we have to balance that against, as more entities come into the clearinghouse, you know, what are the costs and who bears those costs, where those costs get spread out? Obviously, there'll be additional liquidity facilities required, liquidity facilities at the participant level, how they pay for that, what that means for the profile of the market for larger participants versus smaller participants, and sort of that diversity that you want in intermediation. So I think the bottom line is you got to think of the market in a couple of different ways. Think of market participants, their profiles in different ways, and clearly sort of identify where the benefits might be before you move forward with any kind of mandated clearing in the space.
Just real briefly onto what Rob said, we have spent a lot of time looking at all of our clearing models, including our direct clearing model, as well as the sponsored and our other client clearing models, to ensure that we have the ones in place that are necessary to support this broader range of participants. We believe that they are there, right? And that different market participants can access the models in different ways, depending on their business needs. However, there is one area where there's still a significant amount of work that needs to be done, and it kind of dovetails on the point Rob was making about the costs of clearing. So one area that we are working on is this issue of rehypothecation of client margin to FICC. This is something that is particularly challenging to our sponsors and to other institutions that might want to act as sponsors or agent clearers on behalf of institutional investors or on behalf of the PTFs. Right now, they cannot rehypothecate margin freely from the client to the CCP without taking a deduction or a requirement against their 15C33 reserve requirements under SEC regulations. We are working with the SEC and the community to see if there is a way that FICC can get relief from that requirement such that margins can be freely rehypothecated in the same way that they are able to be done in other markets. I would say that's a key area where there is cost today.
Pat, maybe I would just add to Rob and Laura. So generally, I and the team at BNY Mellon support the idea that central clearing does provide risk mitigant or risk reduction. I also think there's some lessons from the derivative markets that people are bringing across to this market. I do think that, like in any market or structural change, it's a question of what's the priority risk reduction? And then are there certain types of transactions which would reduce more risk that should be centrally cleared first? And then would all transaction being centrally cleared adversely affect liquidity, which I think it would if that was the case. So we're certainly proponents and positive on central clearing and will be an important part of actually settling that. But I think it's a question of which transactions.
Now, just to finish the thought on that, I think Laura raised a good point, too. We talk about incentives to clearing, and I think, again, across the market, there are significant incentives, but eliminating disincentives to come into clearing are important factors as well, obviously, highlighting that. But the rehypothecation of collateral within the margin, I think that's important. And if there are others, we just need to understand what those are before moving forward with any kinds of mandates in any sectors of the market.
All right. Why don't we move on to our third and last issue? And this is the issue about banking regulation, where large banks are subject to something called the supplemental leverage ratio. Earlier, there were references to how much balance sheet repo transactions take up. Well, really, there's requirement under which it takes up so much balance sheet is not the risk-based capital requirements, but the leverage ratio requirements, in particular, the so-called supplemental leverage ratio. So how might banking regulators provide SLR relief from the current constraint that the supplemental leverage ratio poses, without impairing bank safety and soundness? Because there are lots of folks, particularly, I think, progressives, who feel that the leverage ratio is something of a third rail. So this is going to be a tough one, I think, for the Fed to move forward on. And they promised to do so way back last March, and almost a year later, when they said something would be forthcoming soon, we still haven't seen anything. So Rob, you want to start this off?
Yeah, thanks, Pat. When we look back to March 2020, in particular, that particular dislocation event, the capacity didn't seem to be there, or there seemed to be various constraints. Agreed, it was a one-way market, but some dealers thought they were pressing up against, as you kind of described it, the supplemental leverage ratio and what that meant to their ability to come into the market and continue to make markets during a significant downturn. I think what happened in 2020, and at least as an illustration of possible ways forward to help with that capacity issue and allow dealers to continue, you know, even in a significant market downturn, to operate and to intermediate and provide that liquidity, portions or bits of the calculation of the supplemental leverage ratio were suspended for a period of time, particularly the use of the inclusion of cash on deposit at the central bank within the calculation. Now, this is, you know, firms have deposit accounts at the Federal Reserve, and this was calculated or included in the calculation of the SLR. And when it was suspended, its inclusion within the calculation, things at least seemed to improve from a dealer intermediation standpoint. This now has been reimposed. As Pat said, we did think there was going to be some movement on this from the Federal Reserve going forward. There are political considerations here that I think are going to make it a little more difficult to move this forward. You know, this is risk-free cash at the central bank, and it should be reflected as such in the capital requirements of the institutions that are subject to the SLR. But going back to the looking forward capacity that we're going to look for in the dealing community too, we all know that the Treasury is going to be issuing, I think, significantly more amounts of debt going forward. That's going to have to be absorbed by the dealer community, and the dealer community is going to have the capacity to be able to deal with it. We think this will be a significant change, if we were to get there, a significant change that would allow increases in that necessary capacity for market intermediation.
Maybe I'll jump in and add one or two things to that. Rob's excellent discussion of that. I think the basic point is that banking regulators have consistently said that this supplemental leverage ratio should serve as a backstop to the risk-based capital ratios rather than a requirement that frequently binds on many banks. But it's become the binding requirement, and still is today, for many of the banks that are the most important intermediaries in the Treasury market. Now, why is that? That's largely because of the extraordinary and unanticipated growth in banks' holdings of reserve balances, that is, deposits at the Fed. In 2014, when the Fed first put the supplemental leverage ratio in place, it projected reserves to decline to a negligible $25 billion in 2021. That's billion with a B. But today, reserve balances are nearly $4 trillion. That's trillion with a T. The simplest way, I think, to restore the SLR to its intended backstop role would be to exclude reserves, which are, as Rob pointed out, after all, riskless assets, which shouldn't seem to need capital backing from that SLR calculation. And importantly, because risk-based capital requirements would remain in place and are, in fact, being strengthened in the process going on in Basel, bank safety and soundness would not be impaired by that change. That said, as several people have already mentioned, politically, that's going to be a tough issue for the Fed to wrestle with, and that probably explains why they've been slow addressing it. I think we've more than run out of time to discuss the particular issues, so just to make a couple of concluding remarks, we've discussed three sets of reforms. The discussion underscored that no single measure can make the vital Treasury markets as resilient as they need to be. Moreover, in important respects, these three sets of measures are complementary. Thus, market participants and policymakers need to continue to work together on each of these fronts. I think the example of the importance of relief from the rehypothecation constraints that the SEC regs put on broker-dealers is a good example where it's absolutely essential they work together. So again, thank you. Thank you, Vanadium.
Thank you, Patrick, and BNY Mellon for hosting this episode. Head to Aerial View Magazine at certaintybnymellon.com for the full BNY Mellon article or to subscribe to their content. Thank you for listening to The Financial Bite. We invite you to visit our website on finadium.com and to follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn for additional content.